And now I would like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Patty C. from San Diego.
I'm Patty. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Randy and the members of the speaker committee for asking me to participate and come on out tonight. It's always an honor and a privilege to do anything for AA, even when it feels like you don't really want to do it, like the area assembly today. but it's an honor and privilege to be there, and it's an honor and privilege to be here, and I want to thank my husband for driving the 10 minutes that it took to get here. That was nice. that was lovely. And you know, just hi to everybody. I see a bunch of people I know from Kelton and some other meetings, and I always love that, you know, coming to AA and just seeing people I know, and, you know, you just feel at home and a part of. And if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous or you just celebrated 90 days, welcome and congratulations for the 90-day people. You know, I remember when I celebrated 90 days, and my sponsor's boyfriend gave me my 90-day token, and I still have it. You know, that was, and part of it is a little bit of ego, because back in the day they were heavy and like they, you know, they felt like weight or something, and I just like the feel of it. And now it's all like blue from oxidation, and you know, and I like that it's old looking and it's mine. And I'll give other people other 90-day tokens, but I kept mine. It's always been really special to me. You know, and if you are new, I want to welcome you and let you know that, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous works, and I don't know, I feel like it's a really, my first year of sobriety was awesome. I had a great first year of sobriety, to be honest. It was hard, but it was a lot of fun, and, you know, it just changed, my whole world changed in a year, you know, my outlook on life and my relationships with others, and a year is just not a lot of time, and yet a lot of stuff changed. You know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, we talk about what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today, and I was thinking about, you know, my birthday's coming up next month, and I was thinking about that because congratulations to Bill, who just took 31 years, because I, too, will be 31, but not in sobriety, just in life, next month. And I was just thinking, you know, how randomly cool is that, that, like, you know, 31 years ago, Bill got sober, my mom was pregnant, and then, you know, 31 years later, she was, like, really pregnant at that point, I think. You know, and like 31 years later, here we are, you know. And I just think that's cool, and happy birthday. And also, I kind of dig that this is recorded and it's going to be put online, because I know that there's a group, I think, in South Africa that listens in and they download this. And, you know, this is part of what they do for sobriety. And I just want to give them a shout out. Woo, South Africa! You know, like... we feel you, and I'm excited that they're listening, you know, and I think that, you know, you could get sober anywhere and stay sober anywhere, any world, any place in the world. Just get that big book, you know, get that big book. And I started drinking when I was 10, and I always feel so weird about that, you know, because I see 10-year-olds, and I'm like, my God, they're so young, and I just think how horrible. I can't believe I was drunk at 10, but there I was. You know, the venue was my Uncle Peter's wedding, and I was with my father, and I'm from Connecticut. That's where I grew up, and my dad is from Canada. He's from Montreal, and he's not French-Canadian. His family is really American, but they moved up to Montreal for various reasons. My father's family is a wonderful, classy bunch of people that really have all the promise in the world. But they're just plagued by this disease. I mean, God, it's so sad. You know, they're just elegant, elegant people. And it's just, it runs like wildfire in my family, and it's horrible. I was at my Uncle Peter's wedding, and, you know, he's the uncle that was, like, the fun one, you know? He's the one that loves all his nieces and nephews and hangs up us by our toes and bites them and, like, you know, chases us around, and he's the one that's totally fun and great, and he got married to this beautiful woman, Christina, and she was, you know, gorgeous. They were this beautiful, young, really hip couple. They were, you know, kind of European. They spoke French, and they were, you know, really elegant and you know, just really neat people. And I was with my dad and my brother. My parents are divorced, and, you know, I was with the family, and it was their wedding, and I was the flower girl, and I had two dresses, one for the wedding and one for the party, and I don't know why I insisted on that, and I don't really know why they okayed that, but they did. You know, I got my two dresses, and I was at my grandparents' home, and they had a tent up in the backyard, and there was a band, and one of my girlfriends who was there, I had two girlfriends there, and one, they both brought me a champagne flute, and, you know, I always think that, wow, I started high class, you know, like champagne, and I just remember, like, I just downed one, and I started sipping the others, because I thought that's what the other, you know, the other women were doing, the grown-ups, and I just proceeded to just keep drinking, and I got really drunk, and I loved it. I mean, I had a great time, and I also remember, and I find this so interesting, I remember I got up and I sang with the band, with my friend Allegra, and we were singing, like, George Michael's Gotta Have Faith, and, you know, and we're just, like, doing it, and everybody's loving it, and we're all of a sudden the entertainment, but I remember thinking, I would never do this if I weren't drunk. Like, I knew I was drunk, and I knew the effect the alcohol produced for me, and I loved it. And, you know, I was 10, and, you know, the only thing I remember is I think I just passed out, and I woke up because I was 10 in my pajamas the next day. And that was, like, the first time I really just loved drinking. And, you know, I wasn't, like, a daily drinker at 10 from then on out. But I appreciated alcohol, and I always feel kind of weird with this part of my story, but you know, it happened. My sponsor says, you know, if it happened, it happened. There's, you know, you feel weird, don't feel weird. But when I was around 11, we moved from one part of Connecticut to another, which doesn't seem like a big deal, but it was a pretty drastic, it was a very drastic class difference. My father was a stockbroker in the 80s, and we were living like the high life, incredibly, incredibly wealthy. And, you know, I look back and I think about, you know, I drive a Chevy. I just want to clarify that. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm not there now. Like, nothing wrong with a Chevy. I love it. But I'm not, you know, in the limos I once was in at 5 to go to New York to get my hair done with my mom. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not there. And it was different, and it was a different kind of class structure. We moved from Greenwich, Connecticut, which has the highest income per capita in the United States, and to Norwalk, which is basically an industrial town. It's, you know, it has class diversity, which is fine, but I felt really weird. Like, I didn't fit in. Like, on the one hand, you know, here I am coming from private school and, you know, really privileged, like, incredible amount of privilege and wealth, to, you know, just kind of being one of the people. And it was bizarre, to be honest. It was bizarre. And I made friends, but I also felt like I had this whole other experience, and it made me feel different and not really a part of. And but you know what? That's not really why I drank at all. It's just how I felt inside. And, you know, as a kid, I feel like, man, alcoholics were so... You know, I love hearing when Clancy talks about being so oversensitive. I was so oversensitive as a child. I had, like, hyper feelings. And there was nothing really, you know, up to that point wrong with my life. Sure, my parents were divorced, but that's not a big deal in the 80s. You know, like, it really wasn't. My world wasn't that rocked from it. But I would just have those moments of melancholy, you know, and just sadness for no reason and just kind of need the drink. And from a really young age, I'm one of those people that escapes into books. I'll sit there and my whole afternoon will be reading because, you know, there's nothing wrong with reality, but I'd rather just not be in it. You know what I mean? I'd rather just check out. And so I was one of those kids. And when we moved to Norwalk, you know, I made friends with people and stuff, and it was fun. And it was, it was normal to the extent that it is normal. That, you know, I made friends with the girls down the street, and we would rent movies and, you know, eat pizza and play games, and it was, you know, it was normal, etc. But I kind of remember also when it started to change, and, you know, it's so ironic because it changed the night of my best friend's confirmation. And, you know, her kind of induction into the Catholic Church formally. And what happened was we were, I think we were like 12 or 13, and we wanted to go out, and my, somebody's parents drove us to Westport, Connecticut. And so here we are, it's kind of like this middle-class industrial town surrounded by all these incredibly wealthy towns in Connecticut that are really commuter towns where people commute from Connecticut into New York City and into Manhattan or Stamford, Connecticut to work. And so we go out, and all of a sudden I was introduced to like other kids in other towns and that had money, that held older brothers, that scored alcohol. And I think it's significant. Connecticut is significant in my life story for drinking because we have a thing called woods, and it's a group of trees all together that separate property. Just so you know. And the reason why that's significant is because that's a wonderful place to drink. A, B, smoke, and C, hide your empty bottles. It's basically like naturing, sheltering the alcoholic from getting caught. And what's also kind of significant, and you'll find this exotic because we're in San Diego, but you could just kind of like throw your cigarette on the ground, not stomp it out, and it'll just die because it's so wet, bracken there, you know, from the twigs and everything. Like everything just gets very wet, and so you know, that's basically we started drinking like that, and all of a sudden, you know, I had a boyfriend, and he had parties. And, you know, vodka became my drink of choice, and he had the older brother that would, you know, supply us with alcohol. And by this time, I'm in my freshman year of high school, and that was that year that kind of brought me down. In one year, I never was a normal drinker. I had actually tried to get sober when I was 12 the first time, which was a great thing in the sense that at least I was introduced to AA. I just wasn't quite ready yet. And I felt like, man, I'll never be able to relate to these people. I was 12. I was going to AA meetings at 12, which is young. And I was like, I'll never be able to relate to these people. I better start drinking on the side just so I can relate to the alcoholics in AA meetings. So I'd steal alcohol from my mom so that I'd have something to share the next day for you guys. And it was just kind of like that was my mentality. It was like I gotta fit in at any cost. And so at 12, 13, you know, I'm hanging out with these people and we're partying and I'm drinking and then I've got these other girlfriends and we're in high school, 13, 14, and you know, and we're drinking, and next thing I know, I've basically got all these friends, different groups of friends that I can drink with, and rotate, basically, so that nobody knows how much I'm really drinking. And when I drink, and I was talking to my friend Brenna last night, one of my best friends, Brenna, we were going out to a club last night, and we're getting ready at her house, and you know, I'm the designated driver. And that's not why we're friends. It's just how it is, you know. But we're getting ready at her house, and I was talking about drinking, and you know, because I've seen Brenna drink, you know, and she gets a nice buzz going, and she's kind of like got her beat going, and she's dancing. And I'm like, yeah, can you imagine me drunk? It's horrible. And she's like, I picture you kind of like a funny drunk. And I'm like, I am funny, but I'm the one on the floor. I'm the one on the floor, like, waving to the other drunk on the floor. And then, you know what I mean? And you know because you're waving back. This is the room of the drunks on the floor waving. And the Brennas of the world are the ones, like, with, you know, trying to get us up off the floor and take us to the car, right? And Brenna's like, really? You're that kind of drunk? And I'm like, why do you think I'm in AA? Like, of course I'm that kind of drunk. You know, like, I don't drink like you. I'm drinking so that I'm not drinking to get a buzz, first of all, because that's a waste of my time. I'm drinking to, like, you know, oblivion. To like, and because that, for me, is a good time. But, you know, you know, just getting completely wrecked and not remembering anything, really. But, you know, for me, what started happening was, You know, I really, to be a 13, 14-year-old alcoholic, you know, no offense, I'm sure you guys worked for it, but I think it requires a tremendous amount of work and effort and energy, being a very young alcoholic, because nothing's free. Well, nothing's, you know, is easy. You've got to lie, you've got to cheat, you've got to steal, you've got to remember your lies, all you've got to backtrack, all this while drunk. You know what I mean? It's not easy. And that's kind of what happened, you know. There's one party I was at, and my friend had like this split level, and you walk in, and then there's the stairs to go up, and you go up the stairs, and there's just like the red cups and like the array of bottles, and we just, you know, fill up the cup, and we drink, and we drink, and we drink, and then we're, I don't know about you, and I think there's a big difference between being a female teenage alcoholic drunk dialer and a woman drunk dialer who's older. Female teenage alcoholic drunk dialer is all, what's up, I'm drunk, what's going on, you're not here, it's a party! Right? Click. Right? I think the woman drunk dialer, like, gets on the phone and, like, cries or something or calls the ex. Female drunk teenage drunk dialers are, we're just like, we're having a party, what's up, we're here, you're not, sucks to be you, click, right? This is what we do, and then somebody calls my mom, right? One of the people who wasn't invited calls my mom, who comes over, and, you know, and we're just totally drunk, and I'm trying to just hang on to somebody. And my mom, and for some odd reason, and then what happens is my mom takes my girl for a night, and she sits us down at the dining room table and starts asking us all these questions about the night, and we're just making all this stuff up. And next thing I know, my girlfriend and I, we go upstairs to bed. We wake up at like 3 o'clock in the morning because we've got the sweaters and we're super, super thirsty. I'm super fortunate. That's the only real, like, hangover I ever have, was just utter thirst. And we get up, and the next day my mom quizzes us on, like, the conversation we had the night before. And I'm just like, what? And then it kind of comes back to me. And that's just kind of like my drinking. You know what I mean? It was just kind of like, what do I tell my mom? What's the quiz the next day? Like, you know, cover the story, et cetera. And I think to an extent she didn't really want to believe that I was drinking as much as I was. And then there was a series of just parties in the woods with people being beat up here. And then the cops come and we hide under the leaves and, you know, and I'm on the floor and, you know, I love vodka. Vodka's my drink, but we had Crazy Horse. Has anybody heard of Crazy Horse? Like 40-0 of Crazy Horse. It's really cheap beer, and it's like 40 ounces, and I just, like, you know, down what I could, and it's just, I don't know, it was a lot of fun at the time. And, you know, I'd get out, and for some odd reason, I was pretty graced that I always had, I always got home safe. I always had, like, a designated driver. And I was also graced that I was never, like, left alone at a party with a guy. You know what I mean? Like, I was also really graced in that way as well, because I certainly was not responsible at all with anything at that point. And I'd go home, and I'd fall out of the car, and we had these rugs, and I'd follow the lines of the rugs to my mother's room. And I love how I rationalized, you know. And my mom would be like, you smell like alcohol and cigarettes. And I'd be like, you know what, Mom? I was at a high school party. And indeed, I did have a beer and smoke a little bit of cigarettes. And that's just how it is in high school parties. I don't know what to tell you. And she's like, all right, fair enough. You know? And like, you know, and what I really liked about my drinking time period, and why I don't really envy those who drank in the 60s or 70s or 80s, is because I had the 90s. In the 90s, we had grunge. And it was like Seattle. And it was like flannel shirts, Doc Martens, ripped jeans, and look horrible. So you can really drink, look horrible, wake up the next day, wear the same thing you wore the previous day, and still look like a normal person. That was just like, you know what I mean? It doesn't get much better than that. Like, it was cool to look really horrible. And so it was, like, perfect. Like, you didn't have to wash your clothes. You could have stains, whatever. You know, and I had that film on my jeans because I just, you know, I'd like to throw them off and just pass out, wake up the next day or come to your other and throw them back on and go and just maybe change the flannel. And that was it. Maybe a concert T-shirt, you know. And it was perfect drinking. It was perfect drinking. And, you know, and next thing I know, you know, my parents are gone, and I invite Danielle up, and she brings a bottle of vodka, and I'm supposed to be babysitting, and, you know, I had all these great parties, and the next thing I know, I'm like partying, quote unquote, on my bathroom floor with, like, you know, Benson Hedges cigarette, boo, with a bottle of vodka, listening to The Doors, The Best Of, you know, and we're like Dance on Fire as it intends, and this is the party now on the bathroom floor with like a candle, and my brother, who's 10, is banging on the door, wants to know what's going on, and nothing's going on, and we're crawling around, drunk dialing. My mom comes home with my dad, because they're at the parent-teacher night, and my dad's driven down from Rhode Island for this, and I love my dad, because he's such a classic ACOA, and you have to love those guys, because they're in denial about just everything, so I can totally physically, like, hang on to him for support, and he'll support me and think, and just be like, she's fine. She's fine, you know, and my mom will be like, I think she's been drinking, and I'll be like, no, and you know, my dad's like, she's fine, I'm like, I'm fine, my mom's like, oh my God, and then Danielle has to go home, and then it got to the point that they don't want to leave the house. You know, they don't want to leave the house anymore, and they do the sneaky come back early routine, you know, And then next thing I know, I'm that kid in school. I'm the kid in school in the grunged out outfit and like the red lips, and I'm like, you know, listening to Guns N' Roses and Nirvana, and I don't care, and I'm cool, and the band geeks are not because they're band geeks, and I get to drink and you don't, and all of a sudden I'm like a bad, you know, quote unquote bad girl, and I'm hanging out at night and we're walking the streets looking tough, and I don't know how tough I looked at 100 and, like, you know, 5 pounds at 14 years old, but apparently I thought I was incredibly badass. And we're just walking around, and one of my girlfriends, I sat down, and I had a cigarette dangling from my lips, and my girlfriend said, wow, Patty, you look like the kind of girl my mom told me to stay away from. And anybody else would have thought that was, like, an insult, but I was like, that's right. You know what I mean? Like, and it was kind of like, I have arrived. And I loved that. And I thought I was completely more powerful than I was. But the problem was that all of a sudden, now I'm stealing from my brother's piggy bank. You know, like my 10-year-old kid brother had a piggy bank, and he kept an allowance, and he was, like, diligent with that. And I'm feeling ashamed of it, and I'm stealing from my mom, and now I'm lying, and now I'm cheating on tests, and I'm cheating in school, and I can't not cheat. And, you know, I'm just hanging out at home just to, like, get a hot meal and to, like, have a place to sleep. And I know this, and I told my friend that, and I'm bragging about it. I don't have to do anything, you know. My pad's awesome, like, my pad, right? Like, my mom's house is great. This is all I have to do. And my relationship with my father consists of me being the person who manipulates and just says, yeah, thanks for coming down to pick up my brother. I don't want to come with you, but I'll take your $20, you know. And then he'll give it to me. And my mom, you know, looks at me and says, you're not even a member of the family anymore. And I'm like, and I'm looking at her, and I'm like, I'm insulted. How dare you? Of course I'm a member of this family. I come here to eat, you know. And she's like, yeah, I know. It's pretty much all you do. And, you know, and next thing I know, I'm verbally rehearsing my lies to get my story straight, you know, because at that point, what's the truth anyway? I don't know. It's all becoming one big blur between my lies and reality. And do I really care about reality? Not so much, you know. And I remember the scary part for me was I'm sitting with my mom and we're watching a TV show, and there's the psycho killer verbally rehearsing his lies. And my mom's like, what's he doing? And I'm like, I know what he's doing, and I'm relating to the psycho killer on TV. You know what I mean? And I just felt like, that's not right. like, I knew that wasn't right. I was just like, that's not good. And I'm thinking, he's verbally rehearsing his lies to tell the court, you know? And I'm just like, oh, God. And so what happened to me was I start hanging out with, you know, the bad kids. I am the bad kid in school, and I'm dabbling into other substances, and next thing I know, I just don't want to do it anymore. You know, I get where this is going. I don't want to do it anymore. It's Christmas time. We're downtown, and there's a tree lighting ceremony. And years, you know, 2 years before, I had been one of the kids that was singing at the tree lighting ceremony, and now I'm kind of like, you know, basically in the back street alley with like two 22-year-old guys, but five of my friends who are no older than the age of 16, and, you know, and I tell my girlfriends, I'm not going to do any of this, I don't want to do anything, I swear it off with or without a solemn oath, and I'm the first person they pass to, and I can't say no, you know. And next thing I know, I'm basically stoned on the sidewalk in a fetal position, rocking myself. It's snowing, and families are walking by, and I'm slamming my fist on the pavement, wondering how this happened again, you know. And that for me was one of my turning points. And it got to the point not too soon after that where I was in my room and I knew I could not drink. I couldn't do it. I couldn't picture a life not drinking, but I knew I'd die this way. And I knew that. And I was at what the book calls the jumping off point. And if you're newcomer, that's an essential part of, for me, my recovery. I needed to be at that jumping off point where I didn't want to live, but I didn't want to die either, you know. And for me, I had to get on my knees and say the drunk's prayer, and that's what I did. And I said the drunk's prayer, if you're new, is please God help me. And I said, please God help me, because I just don't want to do this anymore. And I was, you know, at that point, I was kind of planning out my suicide because I just couldn't not do it. You know, I could not drink. And that's a really gnarly place to be when you're 14 years old. And so what happened for me was, you know, I saw the light. I had a clear or transparent phone that had all these lights on it. So when the phone rang, like, it would be all, like, huge lights. So it rang, like, at that moment. And it was my best buddy, Lucas. And I said, hey, Luke, you know, I'm not doing too hot. This is going really poorly for me. And he said, why don't you come with me to an Alateen meeting? And I said, okay, I'd go to an Alateen meeting. And you know, Alateen, man, if you're in this room and you think that drinking only affects you, go to an Alateen meeting. You know, suicidal 10-year-olds, 12-year-olds that have to, like, pick up their parents and put them to bed and clean up the vomit, it's gnarly. Alateen's, like, incredibly hardcore. I'll take an Alateen meeting over a meeting in a prison almost any day. It's sad. And it's really unfortunate. And so I went to an Alateen meeting, and I shared what was going on there. And one of the people there said, well, I'll bring you to a meeting. And, you know, the night before I went, I had that last glass of wine. I don't know why I had, like, sips of wine. And I went, and I shared what was going on, and everybody told me how lucky I was to be there and how lucky I was to be there so young. And I did feel lucky. I'll be honest. I felt fortunate, but I also felt really scared and weird, and I didn't know how this was going to work. And I got a couple of numbers, I believe, and I started just going to meetings. And that was February 17th of 1993, and that's not my sobriety date. My sobriety date is June 1st of 1993. And I changed my date because non-alcoholic beer is for non-alcoholics. And I shouldn't be drinking it because it does have 0.5% alcohol in it. And I don't drink anything with alcohol in it, not even 0.5%. So in my sobriety, I changed my date. But I did start going to meetings in February. And I started doing that, and I met this woman, Alyssa, and she took me to a whole bunch of meetings, and she drove me around. And it was hard. I mean, I was really young, and, I was in school, and a lot of my peers that got sober young too switched schools, actually, and I didn't. But the significant part of my story at this point, my real bottom was I was at a meeting once. I'll never forget it. It was a noon meeting, and noon meetings in Connecticut are kind of cool, some of them, because they're lunch meetings. So somebody brings lunch. People put $5 in the basket. They bring cold cuts and, like, you know, chips and stuff like that. And somebody, I noticed a rash on me as I was smoking a cigarette, and I was like, oh, this is a weird rash. And my mom and I showed it to my mom, and we thought that it was like I don't know, hives or something. And so I was, by the way, still 14, so I went to the pediatrician. And yeah, so we go to the pediatrician. She says, "That's not a rash. That's actually like an illness. You've got like a disease of the blood." And I was like, "What?" And so I started going to hematologists, oncologists, doctors who specialize in cancer and diseases of the blood, like leukemia, etc. And I went to the doctor, and my mom was waiting outside, and the doctor looked at me and said, "Yeah, what you have is a very rare disease, and it's caused by an allergy to something." And he looked at me and he said, "What were you doing out there?" And I looked at him, and I'd rather at that point still save face than ask, and I said, "Nothing. Don't worry about it." And he said, "Okay. Well, if you'd kept that up for another month, you'd be dead because there's blood in your urine." And I'm going to need your urine samples every week until I tell you not to. And I'm going to need your blood samples every week also. And that, for me, was my bottom and my turning point as well, because at 14 years old, I was dying of alcoholism and didn't even know it. My blood is physically allergic to alcohol. I can't ingest it. My kidneys bleed. And the insanity of this disease for me is that 3 months later, late at night, I'm smoking, and I want to drink really badly, and I'm calling people, and I want that drink, and I hang up the phone with this woman, Dana, who did answer her phone. And we were talking about it, and she told me to pray or do something, you know, and probably pray and read the first step and ask God to remove the obsession to drink. And I hung up the phone, and I realized I really am an alcoholic, because I had been going to a hematologist-oncologist for 6 months prior to that. It was probably, I think, in October. And my rash, and I had rashes all over my legs. My legs would go into convulsions in the night because of the itching. They swelled up. I wasn't allowed to walk or to go to school. My mom had me homeschooled. My days in my first months of sobriety, to be perfectly honest, were me waking up, going to the doctor, them taking my blood and my urine, you know, checking to see if there was any blood in my urine. My mom taking me back to bed, where I'd sleep with my feet elevated so that my feet wouldn't swell anymore, and my mom would go downstairs and cry because she had a sick child. And, you know, I see parents today with children, and I don't know how she did it, because I was dying of this disease at 14 years old. But, you know, she took me out of school, and I was homeschooled, and people in AA were gentle with me. You know, they really were. And, you know, a couple months after that, my rash cleared up, and the doctor said, "You're in remission. Let's just hope it doesn't come back." And I asked, you know, what were the next steps? And he said, "Prednisone, then we start removing your spleen, then we just start taking out your stuff, you know, your organs." And I was like, "Oh my God, this is really bad." He's like, "Yeah." And, you know, months later, there I am wanting to drink. And what else is that? What else is this but alcoholism that makes me still want to drink? Or, you know, 16 years after I get sober, think maybe I can have a drink with Brenna at the club. Just an Appletini. See what it tastes like. You know? But I don't drink like Brenna drinks. You know? I don't. She gets a buzz. Maybe she wants to go in the pool. Maybe she doesn't. But she's not going to be on the floor, and her kidneys aren't going to bleed. And, you know, she's going to go home that night and be okay and not do the things that you and I will do. And so... You know, what happened was I got sober. That got me. If you're wondering how somebody could get sober and stay that way at 14, that's how. Kidneys bleeding, hematologist, oncologist, etc. That's how I got sober and stayed sober. And that was my first step, to be perfectly honest. And after Alyssa, I met a woman, quote unquote, she was 17 years old and she had what I wanted. She went through high school sober and I really wanted to know how to do that. So I got her to be my sponsor. And for some odd reason, God graces me with these incredibly short women who are very powerful. She was a short Italian woman, a 17-year-old, and she said, "This is what you're going to do. You're going to go to these meetings." And she was kung fu. She was like ninja, you know. She, Kristen said, "This is what we do. You're going to go and you're going to answer phones at Intergroup," which, by the way, in Connecticut in December is different than San Diego, right? Because we're doing 180s trying to get to, like, in 360s trying to get there because of the snow. But we did it, you know, and I got commitments at the meetings I went to, and I became an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And after 90 days, we signed up to go speaking at places in New York and Brooklyn and, you know, other parts of Connecticut. And you know, we traveled all over the place, and it was awesome. And there was a bunch of young people that came in, and we had our primary purpose, you know, to stay sober, and we'd have fun events and stuff like that. But, you know, the real main thing was I went to tradition meetings. I went to Big Book meetings. I went to STEP meetings. I went to Living Sober meetings. I went through the steps with my sponsor. I made amends to my parents. I made amends to that brother I stole from. And I graduated high school, and I had all those experiences that, you know, kids get to have, and I got to do it sober, and I'm so grateful for that. And I used to go to speaker meetings all the time, and I'd hear people talk about their 20s and their teens and how that, you know, that they were just wasted and gone, and they wish they reclaimed that. And I want you to know that was not wasted on me. I heard that loud and clear, and I intended to fully enjoy my youth. And you know what? I did. When I graduated high school, I worked for a year, and then my mom was getting remarried. And I decided, you know, I think I'm going to be a star and go out to L.A. And but I knew my mom wasn't going to fund that plan, right? But she would fund college. So I did that, and I moved out to Los Angeles. And what I love is before I left Connecticut to go to Los Angeles, I got L.A. Central Office to send me a meeting directory, which, by the way, is like five times, the County of Los Angeles meeting directory is five times larger than the state of Connecticut's meeting directory. You know what I mean? It's like large. And I was like, oh my God, and there's all these interesting meetings, and I shared in my group, and they gave me, you know, I had a huge going away party, and there was a guy from my group who said, hey, I know this guy, Ian, you know, get him to take you to a meeting. So I called him before I left Connecticut, and, you know, 2 days into being in L.A., he picked me up for a meeting, and I went to a meeting. And what was funny was my sponsor at the time, Susan, said, you know, try to find a guy named Clancy and go to his meetings. If you can do that, do that. And I was like, you know, in all my infinite, you know, 18-year-old wisdom, I was like, Susan, how am I going to find some dude named Clancy in L.A.? Do you know how big L.A. is? And she's like, just try to find him. And I'm like, whatever. So I go, and I'm like, all right, I'll try to find this dude named Clancy. The first meeting I go to is Monday Night Ohio Street in L.A., which is one of Clancy's offshoot meetings, right? And I had no idea I was there. And it was magical. I walk up to this guy named Brian, who does the taping at Pacific Group Wednesday night, and he was at that point the secretary of Monday Night Ohio, and I said, I need a sponsor who will take me through the steps as outlined in the big book, because I didn't know what you crazy Californians were doing out here. I don't know if you were doing some weird Hazelden thing, you know what I mean? And so he just looked me up and down and said, come with me, kid. And you know, he took me up to this, like, really, again, short, powerful woman named Kenna. And some of you know Kenna, she's a really great speaker, and she was my first sponsor in L.A., And she had what I wanted one more time. You know, she went through college sober, and I didn't know how to do that, and I wanted that. And I lived in a dorm, and I went through college sober, which, you know, and I lived, by the way, next to the party room in my dorm. There was the party room, which means that it's impossible to sleep the night of a party. You don't. But that's okay, because you're 18. You don't need to sleep. You know what I mean? Like, 18-year-olds, they don't need to sleep. Not really. And, you know, so I lived in the party room, and I remember thinking, man, this is going to be tough. But you know what? I went to this Friday night women's meeting, and I asked them, what do? Do I tell these people I'm an AA? Because, you know, it's scary. I don't want to be ostracized or people think that I'm weird. And they said, it's too big of a secret not to tell, you know, the people that you're living with that you're not an AA or that you're an AA. And I said, okay. So I made a group of girlfriends, and I told them I was an AA. And, you know, that year they gave me my cake at my party or at my meeting. Like, you know, the four of them came, and we all drove down my meeting, and they were the ones that gave me my birthday cake, and they stayed for the meeting. And, you know, we'd go out to Hollywood and to go party and stuff, and they'd wait till I got home from my meetings to join them, you know. And it was just, I didn't know friendships could be like that, because when I was drinking, my friendships became more like, you know, where's the alcohol, who's bringing it, you know, how much do you have, etc. And instead, I was making, you know, friendships with people who were real friends. And Kenna eventually went to finish up her education, and so she left. And what I loved about her sponsorship is that there's no ego involved in having sponsees for her. You know, she knew she had to get rid of me before she left. I had to be with somebody else. I had to be taken care of. And she took care of me. And she said, give me your list. I want your list of who you're going to replace me with. And I'm like, no, you'll never be replaced. She's like, yeah, I want your list next week. You know, and I'm like, okay. And we picked Leslie, who's been my sponsor now for 10, almost 11 years, I think. And you know, Leslie had something I wanted, too. She knows how to be a woman, independent, in Alcoholics Anonymous, and in life, you know. And she's an amazing, amazing woman. She works in an amazing, amazing program, and AA is always number one with her. I remember when I turned, I think I graduated, when I got my master's degree, I called her, and I said, yeah, I've got it, and it's fabulous. And I'm like, you know, what's next for me, Leslie? You know, thinking, I'm sure she'll say something like, oh, you know, try to buy a house or have children or, you know, be a success. And she said, well, you know, our primary purpose is to stay sober and carry the message to other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. So that's all that you're going to be doing, you know. That's your primary purpose in life. And that's totally not what I wanted to hear, you know. I wanted to hear, like, property, prestige. But no, it was just, keep doing what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I went to the Pacific Group, and they hooked me up, and it was hard. You know, when I got to L.A., it was going to be really easy to be anonymous. I'm in L.A., I've got a car, I've got my mom's money, she wants to keep me alive, you know, like. But I got plugged in really quickly. So if you ever move anywhere, you know, just get plugged in real quick. And I went to community college there, and then I came down here to finish up school at UCSD, and I did what we do. I sat in the front row, and I asked questions, and, you know, and I went for it, and I graduated with high honors from UCSD, and I did a year of law school where I met Brenna, and, you know, and then I decided not for me, and I went and I got a master's instead, and I was in my master's program, and I was finishing my thesis, and I needed a job, and I was thinking, man, you know, whenever I project the future how it's going to be, it's never good. It's never like, well, I can't wait to get a job. I'm sure it'll be fabulous. It'll be a great time. It's always like it's going to suck, you know? It's going to be over-air-conditioned, fluorescent lights. I'll probably hate everybody I work with. It's going to be horrible, right? And my sponsor says, yeah, your feelings really don't count here because you need a job. Go get one, right? And I'm just like, and that's the sponsorship that works for me. Like, none of this, I love you, let's talk about feelings. It's like, yeah, get a job. Right. If you don't like something, you know, you want to be a good wife, do the dishes, you know. And it's like, so not what I want to hear, you know. And so I applied for this job and as a legal assistant / paralegal, and I got the job. And you know, I work for a blind attorney who's an amazing man, and I pick him up every day for work, and we've been doing this for two and a half years, and I've been working with him very closely for 4 years, and everything that I wanted to do in law school, go to trial, go to court, all that stuff, because of this job, I get to do with him. And I was, you know, I've always been one of those kind of contentious employees, and this is, you know, I had to, in AA, I found out how to be an employee. I pick him up, I say, hey, Pierre, how was your day? Or how was your weekend? It was good. How was yours? We talk about that. We get to work. And guess what we do? Work. Right? Because when I come here, my primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. And when I go to work, it's to be an employee to my boss. That's it. That's my one primary purpose. That's all I really have to do that day. And I learned how to be the employee in AA and how to work closely with somebody and not be argumentative and just say, sure, you got it. No problem. What's next? Right? I mean, when you think about it, it seems simple, but try doing it when you think you're right. You know what I mean? And my sponsor used to say, well, would you rather be right or happy? And I would say, when I'm right, I am happy. Right? But I'd rather also be employed. So, and I love my job today. You know, I love my life today. I was talking to Sue about that during the break, where I'm like, you know, life is good. I'm having a good time. I also work at a community college where I teach at night, so I'm pretty busy. And my sponsor doesn't care how busy I am. I have 4 meetings I hit a week, no matter what, you know? Because her thing is, if she's going to be a single mother and if she's going to work her week and also do 4 meetings a week and also speak and do all this other stuff, then I'm going to do that too. And I love that. I love that I have no excuse, that she's not going to be like, oh, wow, you sound really busy. Yeah, you're right. Take it down to 2 or 3 meetings. That will never fly with Leslie, right? She's always like, I'm busier than you. Pick the 4th meeting, click, right? And it's like, okay. So now I have my 4 meetings a week, and she told me to, you know, start thinking about AA. So I just got, like a year ago, my GSR commitment at my meeting, and I go to the area assembly, and I love that. And if you're new in AA, get involved. I did an H&I panel. That was fabulous. And I moved to San Diego, and I didn't know if I was going to stay or not. And you guys, it happened. It's so cliche. I want you to know, if you're new, it's completely cliche to have boy meets girl on AA campus and get married. And I always thought, that will never be me. You guys are so unoriginal, right? And then, little do I know, there's me at 24. There's Nick at 24. He's sitting right behind me. And I see this guy, and he's like, hey. And I'm like, hey. And I know how this is going to go. And you know, I met my life partner in here, you know. And AA taught us how to be a couple and how to be married people. And he proposed to me. We met at La Jolla Speakers meeting. He proposed to me there after the meeting when everybody was gone. I said yes, clearly. And we had a wedding. And, you know, I have a good life today. I can be a wife today, and I can have a lot of fun today with my friends and go out and have a good time. And you know what? I don't know how much Brenna drank last night. I'm at the point in my sobriety where I'm not counting her drinks, and I don't know if she drank the whole glass or not. I don't care. It's none of my business. I just know I get to go and have a good time with my girlfriends, go home sober to my husband, make sure everybody gets home okay and safe, and you know, and be of service the next day. And because of that, I'm having an amazing weekend. And, you know, if you're new, I really hope you stay. I hope you get a sponsor. I hope you get the big book. I hope you go through the steps. I hope you get commitments and get out of your head. Thanks.